The Mickey Miles Podcast is brought to you by MEI Travel and Mouse Fan Travel, who will handle your family vacation, reunion, honeymoon, corporate incentive trip, or getaway as if it were their own, bringing premium service and expert advice to help you get the most out of your vacation dollar. Visit them at MEI-travel.com or mousefantravel.com.
Hi, my name is JC Wallace, and I'm from St. Louis. I listen to the Mickey Miles Podcast.
Hi, this is Chris Yancic from Long Island, New York, and I love listening to the Mickey Miles and More Podcast.
Hi, I'm Beth Torak, and I'm from Minnesota, and I listen to the Mickey Milers Podcast.
Hi, I'm Cindy Acey. I'm from Aurora, Colorado, and I absolutely love the Mickey Miles Podcast. Woohoo!
Hi, I'm Dawn, and I listen to the Mickey Miles and More Podcast in Concord, North Carolina.
I'm April Arnold from Columbia, Maryland, and I love the Mickey Miles Podcast.
This is the Mickey Miles and More Podcast, your one stop for information on Disney races, Disney vacations, Disney theme parks, and more. Now, here are your hosts for the Mickey Miles and More Podcast, Michelle Scribner-McLean, Chris Eliopoulos, and Mike Scopa.
Welcome to episode 521 of the Mickey Miles and More Podcast. My name is Mike Scopa, and with me on today's show is Michelle Scribner-McLean, and Michelle and I are welcoming back Len Testa one more time. Len has been talking with us about the cost of the Walt Disney World vacation as it has gone up over the last several decades, and we've talked about a few other things. But today we're going to start off talking about the rite of passage. That is the rite of passage to go to Walt Disney World. So without further ado, let's get back to our discussion.
Well, I mean, I think what it's become is a rite of passage, right?
It was at one time, right? So growing up in the 50s and 60s, right. You saw Walt on TV. You wanted to go to the theme parks. You know, your parents took you when they opened or whatever, and you kind of did that, right?
But not everybody has that rite of passage.
Yeah, and then the longer thing is, right? I mean, we're obviously kids of parents who grew up who knew what Walt Disney was, right? So they were familiar with the Disney product and Walt, and wanted to see the theme parks. They took their kids to the theme parks. We took our kids to the theme parks. But at some point, there will be people who can't afford to do that. And you start getting generations of people who aren't familiar with the Disney product. And I think that's bad for the company in the long run.
Right. Mm.
Because at some point, when you have a group of people who aren't familiar with your product, who don't have the nostalgia or the familiarity with it, you have to spend a lot of money on advertising them.
Mm.
Educating right? them, yeah.
Educating them, right. Why go to Disney versus, you know, go to Europe? You know, I mean, again, for the amount of money that we're talking about here, we could all fly to Paris, right? Paris is cheap these days. You know, why not do that instead if you've got the money? You know?
Yeah, the magic makers are probably the dwindling category.
Yeah. I mean, they're going to age out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So if you've got more and more Americans who are less and less familiar with Disney theme parks, in the long run, isn't that a problem for the business? Yeah. Right? I mean, ignoring all the stuff about the society, isn't that a problem? I mean, imagine Coca-Cola, right? Pricing itself so that fewer and fewer people get to experience Coca-Cola. Does that sound like a good long-term strategy?
Mm-mm.
It doesn't sound like a long-term strategy.
You know, and I'm wondering if Iger understands that, and those people surrounding him are saying, you know, these people who have that nostalgic tie to Walt and the legacy, they're going. So we need to tap into one of the other categories, and maybe that's why we're going to spend. We're going to write a check to Lucas and get the Star Wars brand, and that's why we're going.
That was a good deal. I mean, the acquisitions of Pixar, of the Star Wars franchises and the Marvel stuff, no doubt, good deals.
Right, no brands.
Right? Okay, well, I mean, give him credit. He got the deal done, right? Yeah. There's something to be said for getting a deal done. All very good moves, all very good prices for what they paid for those things, and they seem to be, you know, running reasonably well. I don't know about this year in terms of sequels and Hollywood box office. I don't think it did particularly well this year, but in general, all good acquisitions. The thing that I think it's fair criticism to say the current management team relies almost entirely on financial engineering and external deals to make money and not enough on organic growth.
Right.
And I think if you look at how Disney has made all of its classic stuff, it's come organically. Virtually everything Disney's done that has been good in theme parks has come from within the Disney organization.
But Len, I mean, could we make the same claim about other theme parks? I mean, just considering the two other main theme parks that are in Orlando, SeaWorld and Universal, couldn't we say the same thing about them?
You could. I think, so I thought about this too. SeaWorld is in a whole different category because they have their own set of problems. But like mm-hmm. Universal, I mean, Universal's prices have kept pace with Disney.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the question would be why? They've only got two theme parks. You know, their one-day tickets and their two-day tickets are basically the same as Disney's. Mm-hmm. Their three, four, and up-day tickets are vastly less expensive because, again, they've got less stuff, mm-hmm. right? They've got fewer hotels.
They're I think the hotels are pretty expensive.
You know, with an annual pass, they're actually not. They're not bad at all.
Okay.
They don't have the breadth of hotels. They don't. I will say that their value resort, Cabana Bay, is the best value resort in all of Orlando.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have anything that competes with the Grand Floridian. They don't have, you know, they don't have the variety. The restaurants aren't as good. You know, they don't. I would say City Walk is not as good as Disney Springs these days. Mm-hmm. But the thing, the onus on Disney is that they sort of set the market for all of this stuff. I mean, they are the gold standard in theme parks, and what they do, other people will copy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if Disney raised prices to $200 a day, Universal would do something similar
mm-hmm.
because they could, right? And if Disney lowered prices to $50 a day, Universal would have to do the same thing, right? So Disney, in effect, sets the market for Universal, and they don't have quite the same responsibility as Disney does in this particular area. At least I think. I mean, I could be totally wrong on this.
So in terms of growing a following and then, you know, the next few decades, they're not really, you think that they're just following what Disney does?
No, they could, but they're constrained on land, mm-hmm. right? And that's a huge thing, right? Every time they need to buy a sizable chunk of land, you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars in investment mm-hmm. where, you know, Disney's already got the land. But again, that goes back to Walt, right? So that's
right.
The current management, even Eisner, you know, they benefited from that decision, but they didn't make that decision themselves. Mm-hmm. Universal didn't, right? Universal has to fight for every acre that they get, and it's always going to be that way, right? They're never going to get 27,000 acres. Right. They're never going to get, you know, 5,000 acres. So,
hey Len, do you think that you talked about this group who is spending all day long trying to figure out, you know, different ways.
The revenue optimization people,
yeah.
PhDs in data science, yeah.
Do you think that some of their thought process takes into consideration the and I want to call it, maybe this is not the right word, but the mortgage that's going on when Disney takes on large construction projects, like doing they're doing the bus ways, they're doing a whole bunch of other things around the resort, and obviously they're borrowing money, which is relatively cheap, I guess, these days, and yep. they're paying, you know, a high price. They're paying mortgage every month to pay the banks or the financial institutions that are lending them money. Do you think that goes into the consideration when they're raising prices regarding rooms, resorts, tickets, food? Do you think that plays into this, or do you think that's just not?
I think it does, Elizabeth. Well, so like the revenue optimization team, I don't think they look at that at all. I think they literally look at playing with how much they can charge for prices. And, you know, from my understanding of that group, it literally is, you know, can we get 5 cents here? Can we get 10 cents there?
Right.
Can we get 50 cents here? Can we get 50 cents there? And that's how they do those experiments. It literally is that fine tune thing. The classic example we gave in the book this year was the dining plan. So if you look at how the dining plan is priced out now, Disney makes money whether you use the dining plan or not, because again, they're charging $50 for a steak and, you know, $79 for a complete meal.
Right.
They're going to make money whether you use the dining plan or not. But what they've figured out or what the data scientists have figured out, is that if you buy the dining plan, you're basically risking your entire investment on your ability to eat all of that food.
Right.
So Disney makes money either way, but you assume the risk of whatever your decision is. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of situation that their data scientists are trying to put you in every time. It's right. It's like heads I win, tails you lose.
Right.
But there's no way that Disney ever loses money on those things. And again, it's just I literally think it. I honestly believe this is true. They're trying to find down to the penny the maximum amount of money that you would spend on a Disney vacation before you looked at it and said, you know what, I'm just going to go somewhere else. I literally think they're trying to find where that exact dollar number is, not, you know, within $500 or $200. They're literally trying to find that exact dollar amount.
Yeah, looking for that threshold. Yep.
And again, you know, it was funny because Disney has this data analytics conference every year. This year it was in either late August or early September this year. It was at the Contemporary. And we sent Fred, our data scientist, down there. And a couple of interesting things. One, within Disney's data science community, there are huge fans of touringplans.com. Huge! Fred was a celebrity there. So they love the stuff. Yeah, we had a lot of sort of like off the record conversations with a bunch of data scientists there. And the thing that Fred came away with was, is this how you want to spend your career? Right? Like, do you really want he said they're all very, very smart people, but when you look at the problems that they're solving, is, you know, if you're a PhD, if you have a PhD in statistics or in machine learning or in data science, and the net result of your career is that you figured out how to charge $3.50 more for the dining plan. Is that your legacy? Is that what you've done in your, I mean, at the end of it, when you retire, right? And the story of your life's work is written, is that it? You know? And I think that the interesting thing is that that's not really ever a question in the organization. That was my impression of the communication. So, yeah, anyway. But anyway, yeah, huge fans of TouringPlans.com in the data science community. They're big fans of the Crowd Calendar, huge fans of the Optimizer, the TouringPlans software. I joked with Fred. So apparently one of them told Fred, yeah, we've been trying to copy this for a couple of years, the software, which was kind of great. Yeah, go ahead, guys. Knock yourselves
That's
out.
Great. That's
but,
great.
Yeah, but I told Fred, it's like, you know, we've been working on this thing for, this year's the 20th year I've been working on the software. Is like, you know, wow. if you'd like me to tell you what Disney's going to look like in another 20 years, I'd be happy to tell you. Because anyway, it was kind of funny.
Hey,
I had my moment.
I have a question for you. We talked about admission going up. We talked about the food. Yeah. Have you done any studies, or have you looked into how the average cost of a room, let's say a moderate, has gone up? In comparison,
Wait a minute.
In comparison to an off-site hotel.
Ooh, that's tough. I haven't done off-site. I do have the Caribbean Beach prices.
Okay.
If you want it,
I can tell you that I paid $78 a night for Caribbean Beach Resort back in 1990. $78 a night.
Wow. So I only go back to 1999. The interesting thing about Caribbean Beach is that the prices have basically tracked inflation at Caribbean Beach. Back in 1999, the price for one night was $144.
Really?
Remember when Eisner came in, he started raising the prices. So from, like, I think Caribbean Beach opened in when?
89. Yeah.
Yeah. So he started raising the prices after that. So, but yeah, it was about $234. Adjusted for inflation in 1999, in 2016 dollars. Now it's basically the same. It's $227, so basically exactly the same in terms of prices. And it's generally been that way. So that's the hotels for what they are in that case, you know, I think that's fine. I will say that even if you exclude the construction that's going on in Caribbean Beach, needed a lot of refurbishment. I did a walk around it prior to the construction starting earlier this year, and it was time for a refurbishment there. The paint had peeled, and you could just tell everything was worn. Yeah, I think you know, 30 years is the practical lifespan of a hotel before it needs major refurbishment. So it's at that time.
I can remember when those trees were like really short. Now, if I go there, it's like, oh my God, it's a forest.
It's beautiful, and I hope they keep that. But so Caribbean Beach was actually the first Disney hotel I ever stayed in. So I have a sentimental affection for it, and I like their old-timey air conditioners as well. But yeah, I was kind of surprised that the prices were not more outrageous than they were. I didn't look at like the Grand Floridian or the Polynesian, because I think at the Grand Floridian now you can't get in for less than $700 a night most nights.
Oh. Holy cow!
Yeah, that's a lot of money. So, you know, we'll see. We'll see what happens with Star Wars Land. I think, you know, they opened up Avatar. I give them credit for trying. I don't think Avatar was a success by any measure.
No.
It definitely did not drive attendance to the theme parks this summer. My big concern is with Star Wars that they've pretty much already baked in the two attraction, one restaurant formula. I don't think that's enough to do. I think they will have wished that they would have built three or four attractions, but we'll see. So this is the thing that kills me about Star Wars, right? Other than Harry Potter, which we know is a huge success, I mean, if you don't think your company can build compelling attractions based on Star Wars, right? If you're hedging your bets by only building two rides, what does that say about your confidence in your employees? Right? God, I don't know if we can do this, man. Like, dude, you're the Walt Disney Corporation. You own Star Wars. You have the best theme parks in the world. Roll the dice. Four rides will not make or break the company, right? Why not four? Why two? Right? I don't get it.
Yeah, you know, for two rides in one restaurant, what are you going to spend? Maybe an hour in that area, and then you
probably spend 7 hours in line. But yeah, But I mean,
and that's just for the restaurant.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, if you're playing poker, you've been dealt a straight, right? You're just gonna throw $5 in the pot here. What are we doing, right? That's where I give Eisner credit. Built this stuff, and I'm sure they had the numbers, and because they've all got good people to crunch the numbers and stuff. But I think Eisner went a little bit more with his gut. And you know, I haven't gone back and figured out which things were successes and which weren't. But overall, again, Eisner's second best CEO all time in that company. You know, there's something to be said for that. So we'll see. Anyway,
fascinating, Len. If Disney ever approached you and said, Len, we just think you're such a deep thinker, would you come and work for us and give us your advice?
Disney can't afford me. But I'll give them all the free advice they want.
And we do.
Yeah. Well, the thing I've been thinking about now is like, what happens in 20 years? Yeah, 20 years out. And I don't think the company really thinks 20 years out. Because we talked about this in the last show. Like 50 years from now, Castaway Key is going to be underwater, right? Because of rising sea levels. What happens? And is anyone thinking about this? Because their lease goes out to the year 2097.
Yeah.
What's plan B here? You know? And I don't think that they're... Oh, did you guys see the thing that I did on the blog about the temperature in the Magic Kingdom during summer?
No.
It's another thing that I think about. So, and I didn't know this, but in this blog post where I measured how hot it gets in the Magic Kingdom, and it was based on this. Laurel and I went to Pandora to see VFX one night back in August, and at like 6 or 7 o'clock at night, it was still like 90 degrees, and I'm sweating through. I'm wearing shorts, but I'm like sweating through everything, and it's miserable and it's humid. You know how the Animal Kingdom gets, right? So I'm like, well, you know, the my iPhone app says it's 89 degrees outside. I'm miserable. Why does it feel like it's 110? And so I did some research on it. And here's what I learned. Did you know when they measure temperature, they do it in the shade and not in the sun?
No.
Yeah. So when your iPhone app says it's 89 degrees, it's 89 degrees in the shade. So the next question was, how hot is it in the sun? Mm. And what happens when you consider humidity? So we bought some thermometers, a white thermometer and a dark thermometer, and we measured how hot it is in the sun. And then we factored in the humidity. So when you factor in humidity, you get this thing called the heat index, which is like wind chill, but for heat. Okay. Mm. And it turns out that when it's like 90 degrees in the Magic Kingdom, according to your official thermometer, it's somewhere between 120 and 127 degrees is what it feels like.
Shut the front door.
Yeah,
no,
because
way.
Well, because so being in sunlight will add 10 to 15 degrees to the temperature. So again, when your iPhone app says it's 90, it's in the 90 degrees in the shade. When you put your thermometer in the sun, it's anywhere from, I think it's 5 to 15 degrees, but it averages out about 10. So it's about 100 degrees if you're walking around in the sun. And then if you factor in the humidity and the fact that your body can't evaporate sweat as efficiently when it's humid, it feels like, yeah, anywhere between 120 and 127 degrees.
Wow.
So my next question is this, right? So the other interesting thing about the heat index is it's a nonlinear increase. So every 1 degree in temperature increases the heat index by much more than 1 degree.
Hmm.
So what if the temperature goes up 2 or 3 degrees over the next 30 to 50 years? Or it becomes, or if you start telling people, look, it's 130 degrees, or it feels like it's 130 degrees in the sun in the Magic Kingdom, who's going to go?
Right.
So what the National Weather Service tells you is when the temperatures get that high, every 10 minutes that you spend in the sun, you have to spend half an hour out of the sun recovering.
Oh, my gosh.
So why would you go, right? The other thing we measured that we have to measure is those measurements were sort of chest high, but obviously we know that the ground radiates heat. So if you've got kids in a stroller and they're closer to the ground, obviously because right. they're in a stroller, the temperature for them is going to be much higher. But we haven't quantified how much higher yet.
And they probably have a more difficult time with heat anyway, little kids.
Yeah.
Because they can't say I'm thirsty.
Right. They don't verbalize. Say,
yeah, right.
Exactly,
right.
Yeah. So, I tend to think 20 years out when it feels like it's 130 degrees in that Magic Kingdom, who's going to go? Right. And what do you do then? What does Disney do then?
Right? They're going to raise the price of a soda.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, they could add water misters everywhere. Water misters will bring down the temperature, 10 degrees or so. They could do that. They could add cooling fans in the line. There's like, I think shade. They did a really great job at Navi River Journey. There are things they could do, but the other thing they could do, and this is sort of my idea, and they get going back to Michelle where I said that they can't afford me. I legitimately think they should start lobbying school districts all around the East Coast to go to year-round schools, because then you'd have more time during the cooler months to go visit Disney, and it would spread the crowds more.
Yep.
Those are the things I think about.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
On that note,
so Disney has some challenges, right? And the other thing too is like Port Canaveral will be underwater in 50 years. Where are they going to move their?
All right, yeah, it's all good except for only rich people get to go to Disney. Castaway Key is going to be underwater. It's going to be too hot for us to go there.
There are challenges, but I mean, we can, if there's one thing that we've learned from Epcot, right? It's that people armed with knowledge and technology can address the problems of the future or the challenges. So I firmly believe we can do it. The question is who in the company is working on it, and how much backing do they have by management? So I think
all I can say is you live in the same building as Bill Nye, so get him.
I do. I haven't found him yet. Did I tell you he was during the solar eclipse? He handed out glasses.
Oh, Bill Nye, that's awesome.
Oh, Bill, you're awesome. That's awesome. Cool.
So before we stop this discussion, I want to do a quick 1 or 2 minutes go around the table, and we talked about the cost of the admission, we talked about the cost of the restaurants, we talked about the cost of the of staying at a on-site resort, and I know that all three of us have talked with many people who come to us and say, gee, it's really expensive. To go to Walt Disney World, what can I do to reduce the cost? If we could give them a little elevator speech on how to reduce the costs, what would we say to them?
Things. I would say, if money is that tight, you could stay off site, especially if you're going during a holiday time. There are motels on 192 that are reasonably clean. That you could stay at. I think for multi-day tickets, there are still good third-party discounts from a lot of different places. I think you can eat breakfast and snacks off, bring them in from offsite or buy them ahead of time. I think those are all still good things. You know, the ticket stuff, other than those discounts, I don't think there's a whole lot you can do on it, but yeah, it's doable.
Michelle, thoughts?
Well, I'm not going to answer that question. I'm going to say something else, which is to say that it's addressing what Len said about, you know, keeping the Disney name going forward and, you know, building the name for years to come. I worked at a nonprofit museum, and they didn't make a lot of money, but on Friday nights, it was half price for everyone. It didn't hurt anybody, and it made the museum accessible. Why can't there be times when Disney has, you know, gives away half price tickets or, you know, depending on what your income is? I don't know. It just would be nice to see it accessible to everybody so that everybody can say that they went to Disney if it's something that the family wants to do. It breaks my heart.
Yeah, you know,
I don't know if it's doable. It's probably not. I know, you know, they're a business. I understand that, but meh.
I mean, I hear from people. I mean, work around, and they say one of these days, I have to bring my kids to Walt Disney World. They want to go. It's almost like, you know, we talked about it being a rite of passage. It's almost like, as a parent, it's one of the Ten Commandments that you must abide by. Yeah. While you're a parent and while the kids are at that magical age that I have to take my family there. So they're all tearing their hair out because they really don't know how much it costs. They know it's expensive, but then when they start looking at it, it's like a nightmare.
And I didn't grow up in a family where it was affordable. I never went until I was an adult. So, but it always just made me really, really sad. So I don't know.
I'll say this. I mean, when you know, growing up, my parents were not even moderately affluent. I mean, they were basically lower middle class. I mean, growing up in terms of, and we didn't go to Disney a lot. I mean, I went a couple of times as a kid. You know, they took me. You know, my grandparents took me one time. My parents took me a couple of times. But it was enough. Exactly.
But it was time, Len, when you were looking at that flickering light, and then.
Yep, that's my story.
The rest. Now you know the rest of the story.
Right, that's true. Right. Yeah, so maybe once or twice in a kid's childhood is enough. You know, maybe it's not doesn't have to be every year, every couple of years.
Right.
So. Yeah, I think that for those who are listening, I think that, and you can't say this strongly enough, and that is, look at the research. I mean, do the research, I should say. Take a look at what podcasts say. There are a lot of very intelligent Disney consumers out there who have figured it out. We've talked about it on other podcasts. We talk about it on this podcast. Len, I know you address it in the unofficial guide. There are ways of trimming the costs. It's not going to be maybe as much as you know some people would want, but there are ways around it. Going certain times of the year, staying at certain resorts, staying off the property, looking at discounts. There are so many things. I just think that it's very important for people not to just look at the rack rates for the room and for the rooms and other things and say, I'm just going to bite the bullet and go with it, because there are ways of getting around it. Mm-hmm. So
good advice.
Yeah. So Len, thanks very much for coming. This was very, very enjoyable, very
fascinating,
And I hope that those of you who are listening out there, you know, saw this as a different way of looking at the cost of a Walt Disney World vacation, and hopefully there have been some things that we've said that will help you bring your family to Walt Disney World without having to, you know, donate a kidney. So, exactly. Len, thank you very much, and good luck with Glucose Path.
Thanks very much, Mike. Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you so much, Len. Always interesting.
So
for Len Testa and for Michelle Scribner-McLean and for Chris Saliopoulos, this is Mike Scopa saying we'll see you on the road and in the parks.
The Mickey Miles podcast is brought to you by MEI Travel and Mouse Fan Travel, who will handle your family vacation, reunion, honeymoon, corporate incentive trip, or getaway as if it were their own, bringing premium service and expert advice to help you get the most out of your vacation dollar. Visit them at mei-travel.com or mousefantravel.com.
We hope you enjoyed listening to today's episode of the Mickey Miles and More podcast. If you would like to support the podcast, please go to mickeymiles.podbean.com and click the green Become a Patron button in the upper right-hand corner of the menu bar. We thank you for your support. Don't forget, our discussion continues on Facebook at facebook.com/MickeyMilesPodcast. You can also follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/MickeyMilesPod. Last of all, don't forget, if you have any questions for us, you can send them to questions@MickeyMilesPodcast.com, and we'll try to answer them as soon as possible. For all of us here at the Mickey Miles and More podcast, this is Rick Gregg saying thanks for listening and all your support. And until next time, we'll see you on the road.